Chapter 2, The Importance of Aligning with the Right Internal Triggers, and how by utilizing external triggers, designers can then prompt users with information for the next intended action. In Chapter 3, we learned about the role of the smallest action taken in anticipation of immediate rewards. In Chapter 4, we looked at how variable outcomes influenced repeat engagement. There is one last step in the hook model that is critical for building habit-forming technologies. Before users create the mental associations that activate their automatic behaviors, they must first invest in the product. Changing attitude. In Chapter 1, we learned about the tooth flossing study, in which researchers determined that the frequency of a new behavior is a leading factor in forming a new habit. The study also found that the second most important factor in habit formation is a change in the participant's attitude about the behavior. The finding is consistent with the habit zone graph explained in the first chapter, which illustrates that for a behavior to become routine, it must occur with significant frequency and perceived utility. Attitude change is the movement up the perceived utility axis until the behavior enters the habit zone. But in order for a change in attitude to occur, there must be a change in how users perceive the behavior. In this chapter, we will start by exploring the mystery surrounding how small investments change our perception, turning unfamiliar actions into everyday habits. A psychological phenomenon known as the escalation of commitment has been shown to make our brains do all sorts of funny things. The power of commitment makes some people play video games until they keel over and die. It is used to influence people to give more to charity. It has even been used to coerce prisoners of war into switching allegiances. The commitments we make have a powerful effect on us and play an important role in the things we do, the products we buy, and the habits we form. The more users invest time and effort into a product or service, the more they value it. In fact, there is ample evidence to suggest that our labor leads to love. We irrationally value our efforts. In a 2011 study, Dan Ariely, Michael Norton, and Daniel Mochon measured the effect of labor on how people value things. U.S. college students in America were given instructions to assemble an origami crane or frog. After the exercise, students were asked to purchase their creation, bidding up to $1. Assemblers were informed that a random number between 0 and 100 was to be drawn. If it exceeded their reservation price in cents, the assemblers would return empty-handed. But if it was equal to or less than their bid, they would pay their bid and keep the origami. Meanwhile, a separate group of students located in another room, unaware of the identity of the assemblers, were asked to bid on their origami using the same procedure. Similarly, a third independent group was asked to bid on expert-made origami under the same criteria. The results showed that those who made their own origami animals valued their creation 5 times higher than the second group's valuation and nearly as high as the expert-made origami values. In other words, those who invested labor associated greater value with their paper creations simply because they had worked on them. Ariely calls this the IKEA effect. IKEA, the world's largest furniture retailer, sells affordable, ready-to-assemble household furnishings. The Swedish company's key innovation is its packaging process, which allows the company to decrease labor costs, increase distribution efficiency, and better utilize the real estate in its stores. Unlike its competitors who sell pre-assembled merchandise, IKEA puts its customers to work. It turns out there's a hidden benefit to making users invest physical effort in assembling the product. By asking customers to assemble their own furniture, Ariely believes they adopt an irrational love of the furniture they built, just like the test subjects did in the origami experiments. Businesses that leverage user effort confer higher value to their product simply because their users have put work into them. The users have invested in the products through their labor. We seek to be consistent with our past behaviors. How much do past behaviors alter our future actions? We'd like to think we are free to choose to act in any way we'd like, that our judgment is not clouded by our past actions. But in fact, studies reveal that our past is an excellent predictor of our future. A team of researchers asked a group of suburban residents to place large, unsightly signs in front of their homes that read, "Drive carefully." Two groups were tested. In the first group, only 17% of the subjects agreed to the request, while 76% of those in the second group agreed to post the ugly yard signs. What was the cause of this huge discrepancy? The groups were identical except for one factor. Those in the second group were approached 2 weeks prior to the yard sign request and asked to place a much smaller 3-inch sign that read, "Be a safe driver," in their windows. Nearly everyone who was asked to place the smaller message agreed to this. When the researchers returned 2 weeks later, a whopping majority of these residents willingly replaced the small sign with the large one on their front lawns. The homeowners' greater willingness to place the large, obtrusive sign on their lawns, after agreeing to the smaller one, demonstrates the impact of our predilection for consistency with our past behaviors. Little investments, such as placing a tiny sign in a window, can lead to big changes in future behaviors. We avoid cognitive dissonance. In a classic Aesop's fable, a hungry fox encounters grapes hanging from a vine. The fox desperately wants the grapes, yet, as hard as he tries, he cannot reach them. Frustrated, the fox decides the grapes must be sour and that therefore he would not want them anyway. The fox comforts himself by changing his perception of the grapes because it is too uncomfortable to reconcile the thought that the grapes are sweet and ready for the taking, and yet he cannot have them. To reconcile these two conflicting ideas, the fox changes his perception of the grapes and in the process relieves the pain of what psychologists term cognitive dissonance. The irrational manipulation of the way one sees the world is not limited to fictional animals in children's stories. We humans do this as well. Consider your reaction the first time you sipped a beer or tried spicy food. Was it tasty? Unlikely. Our bodies are designed to reject alcohol and capsaicin, the compound that creates the sensation of heat in spicy food. Our innate reaction to these acquired tastes is to reject them, yet we learn to like them through repeated exposure. We see others enjoying them, try a little more, and over time condition ourselves. To avoid the cognitive dissonance of not liking something that others seem to take so much pleasure in, we slowly change our perception of the thing we once did not enjoy. Together, the three tendencies just described influence our future actions. The more effort we put into something, the more likely we are to value it. We are more likely to be consistent with our past behaviors. And finally, we change our preferences to avoid cognitive dissonance. These tendencies of ours lead to a mental process known as rationalization, in which we change our attitudes and beliefs to adapt psychologically. Rationalization helps us give reasons for our behaviors, even when those reasons might have been designed by others. At a 2010 industry conference, Jesse Schell, a renowned game designer and professor at Carnegie Mellon University, articulated the peculiar train of thought some players exhibit online. Schell examined Mafia Wars, one of Zynga's first breakout hits, which, like Farmville, attracted millions of players. There's definitely a lot of psychology here, because if someone had said, "Hey, we're going to make a text-based mafia game that's going to make over $100 million, you'd say, "I don't think you'll do that, right?" Schell said, channeling the critics of the day who originally dismissed the free, primarily text-based online game. Yet Zynga used its understanding of human psychology to build an irresistible product at the time. Mafia Wars was among the first games to utilize information about players' Facebook friends. It's not just a virtual world anymore. It's your real friends, Shell said. And you're playing, and it's kind of cool. But then, hey, my real friend is better than me. How can I remedy that? Well, I can play a long time, or I could just put $20 in. Aha! It's even better if that $20 I put in validates something I know is true, that I am greater than my college roommate, Steve. Shell went on. Combine that with a psychological idea of rationalization that anything you spend time on, you start to believe. This must be worthwhile. Why? Because I've spent so much time on it, and therefore it must be worth me kicking in $20 because look at the time I've spent on it. And now that I've kicked in $20, it must be valuable because only an idiot would kick in $20 if it wasn't. Shell's description of the quirky process of Mafia Wars rationalization helps demonstrate the strange logic of how we change our preferences. When players contemplate making a purchase, they acknowledge it is unwise to spend money on something that is not good. Yet, just like the fox that perceives the grapes as sour to reduce his frustration at not being able to reach them, players justify their purchases to help convince themselves of something they want to be true, namely, that they are not foolish. The only solution is to keep paying to keep playing. The cognitive changes that lead to behavior change help power the shift in how we view the products and services we use. But how are habit-forming products designed for user investment? How can a product keep users committed to a service until it becomes a habit? Bits of work. In a standard feedback loop, the cue, action, and reward cycle can change our immediate behavior. For example, a radar-equipped sign is an effective way to make drivers immediately slow down by showing them their car's speed relative to the posted speed limit. Yet this pattern differs when it comes to how we form habits with products. The hook model is not just a framework for changing one-time behaviors. It is a design pattern to create unprompted engagement in order to connect the user's problem to the designer's solution. To form the associations needed to create unprompted user engagement, something more than the three-step feedback loop is required. The last step of the hook model is the investment phase, the point at which users are asked to do a bit of work. Here, users are prompted to put something of value into the system, which increases the likelihood of their using the product and of successive passes through the hook cycle. Unlike in the action phase of the hook discussed in Chapter 3, investments are about the anticipation of longer-term rewards, not immediate gratification. In Twitter, for example, the investment comes in the form of following another user. There is no immediate reward for following someone, no stars or badges to affirm the action. Following is an investment in the service, which increases the likelihood of the user checking Twitter in the future. Also, in contrast to the action phase, the investment phase increases friction. This certainly breaks conventional thinking in the product design community that all user experiences should be as easy and effortless as possible. This approach still generally holds true, as does my advice in the action phase, to make the intended actions as simple as possible. In the investment phase, however, asking users to do a bit of work comes after users have received variable rewards, not before. The timing of asking for user investment is critically important. By asking for the investment after the reward, the company has an opportunity to leverage a central trait of human behavior. In an experiment conducted by Stanford researchers, two groups of people were asked to complete a task with the help of computers. The participants were initially asked to use their assigned computers to answer a series of questions. The computers provided to the first group were helpful when answering participants' questions, while those provided to the second group were programmed to be unhelpful, offering unclear answers. After completing the task, participants then switched roles and the machines began asking the people for assistance with their questions. The study found that the group given helpful computers performed almost twice as much work for their machines. The results showed that reciprocation is not just a characteristic expressed between people, but also a trait observed when humans interact with machines. Conceivably, we humans evolved the tendency to reciprocate kindness because it improved our species' ability to survive. As it turns out, we invest in products and services for the same reasons we put effort into our relationships. The big idea behind the investment phase is to leverage the user's understanding that the service will get better with use and personal investment. Like a good friendship, the more effort people put in, the more both parties benefit. Storing value. Unlike physical goods in the real world, the software that runs our technology products can adapt itself to our needs. To become better with use, habit-forming technology utilizes investments users make in the product to enhance the experience. The stored value users put into the product increases the likelihood they will use it again in the future and comes in a variety of forms. Content. Every time users of Apple's iTunes add a song to their collection, they are strengthening ties to the service. The songs on a playlist are an example of how content increases the value of a service. Neither iTunes nor their users created the songs, yet the more content users add, the more valuable the music library becomes. By aggregating content with one service, users can do more with their music, and iTunes gets better with use by learning their preferences. With users' continued investment, more songs also become accessible on multiple Apple devices. In 2013, Apple revealed that its new iTunes radio service would provide personalized music recommendations based on the kind of music in the user's iTunes collections. The new feature provides yet another example of how technology adapts and improves based on users' investment. Content can also be created by a service's users. For example, every status update, like, photo, or video shared on Facebook adds to the user's timeline, retelling the story of one's past experiences and relationships. As users continue to share and interact with information on the service, their digital life is recorded and archived. The collection of memories and experiences, in aggregate, becomes more valuable over time and the service becomes harder to leave as users' personal investments in the site grows. Data. Information generated, collected, or created by users, for example songs, photos, or news clippings, are examples of stored value in the form of content. Sometimes, though, users invest in a service by either actively or passively adding their own personal data. On LinkedIn, the user's online resume embodies the concept of data as stored value. Every time job seekers use the service, they are prompted to add more information. The company found that the more information users invested in the site, the more committed they became to it. As Josh Ellman, an early senior product manager at the company, told me, if we could get users to enter just a little information, they were much more likely to return. The tiny bit of effort associated with providing more user data created a powerful hook to bring people back to the service. Mint.com is an online personal finance tool used by millions of Americans. The service aggregates all of the user's accounts in one place, providing a complete picture of their financial life, but only if they invest their time and data in the service. Mint provides multiple opportunities for users to customize the site and make it more valuable with use. For example, the act of linking accounts, categorizing transactions, or creating a budget are all forms of investment. The more data collected, the more the service's stored value increases. Followers. On the morning of Twitter's initial public offering on November 7, 2013, a news commentator on Bloomberg Television said that The technology needed to build the company could be built in a day. In fact, he was right. Twitter is a simple application. With a bit of basic programming know-how, anyone can build their very own clone of the multi-billion-dollar social media behemoth. In fact, several companies have tried to supplant the popular social network. One of the most notable attempts came from a disgruntled developer who decided to build App.net, an ad-free alternative that many tech industry watchers argue is actually a better product. However, like other attempts to copy the service, App.net has failed to take off. Why is this? Collecting people to follow on Twitter, as well as collecting followers, provides tremendous value and is a key driver of what keeps Twitter users hooked. From the follower side of the equation, the more Twitter users curate the list of people they follow, the better the service will be at delivering interesting content. Investing in following the right people increases the value of the product by displaying more relevant and interesting content in each user's Twitter feed. It also tells Twitter a lot about its users, which in turn improves the service overall. For the tweeter seeking followers, the more followers one has, the more valuable the service becomes as well. Content creators on Twitter seek to reach as large an audience as possible. The only way to legitimately acquire new followers is to send tweets others think are interesting enough to warrant following the sender. Therefore, to acquire more followers, content creators must invest in producing more and better tweets. The cycle increases the value of the service for both sides the more the service is used. For many users, switching services means abandoning years of investment and starting over. No one wants to rebuild a loyal following they have worked hard to acquire and nurture. Reputation. Reputation is a form of stored value users can literally take to the bank. On online marketplaces such as eBay, TaskRabbit, Yelp, and Airbnb, people with negative scores are treated very differently from those with good reputations. It can often be the deciding factor in what price a seller gets for an item on eBay, who is selected for a TaskRabbit job, which restaurants appear at the top of Yelp search results, and the price of a room rental on Airbnb. On eBay, both buyers and sellers take their reputations very seriously. The e-commerce giant surfaces user-generated quality scores for every buyer and seller and awards its most active users with badges to symbolize their trustworthiness. Businesses with bad reputations find it difficult, if not impossible, to compete against highly rated sellers. Reputation is a form of stored value that increases the likelihood of using a service. Reputation makes users, both buyers and sellers, more likely to stick with whichever service they have invested their efforts in to maintain a high quality score. Skill. Investing time and effort into learning to use a product is a form of investment and stored value. Once a user has acquired a skill, using the service becomes easier and moves them to the right on the ability axis of the Fogg behavioral model we discussed in Chapter 3. As Fogg describes it, non-routine is a factor of simplicity, and the more familiar a behavior is, the more likely the user is to do it. For example, Adobe Photoshop is the most widely used professional graphics editing program in the world. The software provides hundreds of advanced features for creating and manipulating images. Learning the program is difficult at first, but as users become more familiar with the product, often investing hours watching tutorials and reading how-to guides, their expertise and efficiency using the product improves. They also achieve a sense of mastery, rewards of the self, as discussed in Chapter 4. Unfortunately for the design professional, most of this acquired knowledge by users does not translate to competing applications. Once users have invested the effort to acquire a skill, they are less likely to switch to a competing product. Like every phase in the hook model, the investment phase requires careful use. It is not a carte blanche tool for asking users to do onerous tasks. In fact, quite the opposite. Just as in the action phase described in Chapter 3, to achieve the intended behavior in the investment phase, the product designer must consider whether users have sufficient motivation and ability to engage in the intended behavior. If users are not doing what the designer intended in the investment phase, the designer may be asking them to do too much. I recommend that you progressively stage the investment you want from users into small chunks of work, starting with small, easy tasks and building up to harder tasks during successive cycles through the hook model. As we have just seen, users store value in the service during the investment phase. However, one other key opportunity found in the investment phase greatly increases the likelihood of users returning. Loading the next trigger. As described in Chapter 2, triggers bring users back to the product. Ultimately, habit-forming products create a mental association with an internal trigger. Yet, to build the habit, users must first use the product through multiple cycles of the hook model. Therefore, external triggers must be used to bring users back around again to start another cycle. Habit-forming technologies leverage the user's past behavior to initiate an external trigger in the future. Users set future triggers during the investment phase, providing companies with an opportunity to re-engage the user. We will now explore a few examples of how companies have helped load the next trigger during the investment phase. 1. Any.do. User retention is a challenge for any business, but especially for consumer mobile applications. According to a study by a mobile analytics firm, 26% of mobile apps in 2010 were downloaded and used only once. Further data suggests people are using more applications but engaging with them less frequently. Any.do is a simple mobile task management app used to record to-do items such as picking up dry cleaning, restocking the fridge with milk, or calling mom. Recognizing the challenge of retaining fickle mobile consumers, the app is designed to direct users to invest early on. During the first use of the app, Any.do elegantly teaches how to use the product. The trigger comes in the form of the app's clear, easy-to-follow instructions. The follow-up action is doing what the app tells the user to do. The variable rewards arrive in the form of a congratulatory message and the satisfaction of mastering the app. The investment comes next. Newcomers are instructed to connect the app to their calendar service, granting Any.do access to the user's schedule. In doing so, users give the app permission to send a notification after the next scheduled meeting ends. This external trigger prompts users to return to the app to record a follow-up task from the meeting they just attended. In the Any.do scenario, the app sends an external trigger to users at the moment when they are most likely to experience the internal trigger of anxiety about forgetting to do a task after a meeting. The Any.do app has anticipated a need and sets users up for success. 2. Tinder. In mid-2013, a hot new company entered the hyper-competitive online dating market. Tinder quickly captured the attention of millions of people looking for love with a simple interface, generating 3.5 million matches from 350 million swipes each day. After launching the mobile app and logging in with Facebook, users browse profiles of other singles. Each potential match is presented as a card. Swipe left if you are not interested, right if that special someone catches your fancy. If both parties express interest, a match is made and a private chat connects the two potential lovebirds. By simplifying the investment of sorting through potential mates, Tinder makes loading the next trigger more likely with each swipe. The more swipes, the more potential matches are made. Naturally, each match sends notifications to both interested parties. 3. Snapchat. As of June 2013, Snapchat, a popular photo-sharing app, boasted of 5 million daily active users collectively sending over 200 million photos and videos daily. This tremendous engagement means an average Snapchat user sends 40 photos every day. Why are users so in love with Snapchat? Its success can largely be attributed to the fact that users load the next trigger every time they use the service. Snapchat is more than a way to share images. It is a means of communication akin to sending a text message with the added bonus of a built-in timer that can, based on the sender's instructions, cause the message to self-destruct after viewing. Users pass through the investment phase of the hook model each time they send a selfie, doodle, or goofy photo. Each photo or video sent contains an implicit prompt to respond. The Snapchat interface makes returning a pic incredibly easy by twice tapping the original message to reply. The self-destruct feature encourages timely responses, leading to a back-and-forth relay that keeps people hooked into the service by loading the next trigger with each message sent. 4. Pinterest. Like many social networks, Pinterest loads the next trigger during the investment phase of the hook. For many of the site's 50 million monthly users, the online pin board replaced the habit of browsing fashion-focused websites and, before the web, flipping through magazines and dog-earing favorite pages. The internal trigger for users is often boredom, for which the site offers a quick cure. Once registered, the only action required of users is to start scrolling, as Pinterest showcases a wealth of variable rewards. First, because Pinterest is a socially curated collection of interesting items, the site displays a powerful intermittent reward surrounding the hunt for objects of desire, even if they are only images. The site also provides a means of communicating with friends and people who share similar tastes. The rewards of the tribe come from the variability of posting images as a communication medium. A user might be curious to know what a friend has pinned not only because of the image itself, but because of her relationship with the pinner. Finally, Pinterest users invest in the site every time they pin an image of their own, repin someone else's image, comment on, or like a piece of content on the site. Each of these tiny investments gives Pinterest data it can use to tailor the site to each user's individual taste. It also loads the next trigger. Each pin, repin, like, or comment gives Pinterest tacit permission to contact the user with a notification when someone else contributes to the thread, triggering the desire to visit the site again to learn more. Pinterest clearly demonstrates the four stages of the hook model. It is a seamless flow, from the itch of the internal trigger that moves users to the intended action, through the variable reward, and finally to the investment, which also loads the next external trigger. Pinterest users move through the hook cycle from beginning to end, then happily return to the starting point for another go-round. In this chapter, we have learned how an investment in the product serves as the string that pulls the user back. To do this, the habit-forming technology increases the value of the product with each pass through the hook. Through successive cycles of the hook model, users increase their affinity for the experience. They increasingly come to rely on the product as the solution to their problems until finally the new habit and routine is formed. The more users invest in a product through tiny bits of work, the more valuable the product becomes in their lives and the less they question its use. Users do not stay hooked forever, though. Invariably, the next big thing will come along and provide a better, more compelling hook. However, by creating habits fueled by investments in a product or service, companies make switching to a competitor difficult. User habits are hard to break and confer powerful competitive advantages to any company fortunate enough to successfully create them. Remember and share. The investment phase is the fourth step in the hook model. Unlike the action phase, which delivers immediate gratification, the investment phase concerns the anticipation of rewards in the future. Investments in a product create preferences because of our tendency to overvalue our work, be consistent with past behaviors, and avoid cognitive dissonance. Investment comes after the variable reward phase when users are primed to reciprocate. Investments increase the likelihood of users returning by improving the service the more it is used. They enable the accrual of stored value in the form of content, data, followers, reputation, or skill. Investments increase the likelihood of users passing through the hook again by loading the next trigger to start the cycle all over again. Do this now. Refer to the answers you came up with in the last Do This Now section to complete the following exercises. Review your flow. What bit of work are your users doing to increase their likelihood of returning? Brainstorm three ways to add small investments into your product to load the next trigger, store value as data, content, followers, reputation, and skill. Identify how long it takes for a loaded trigger to re-engage your users. How can you reduce the delay to shorten time spent cycling through the hook? Chapter 6. What are you going to do with this? The hook model is designed to connect the user's problem with the designer's solution frequently enough to form a habit. It is a framework for building products that solve user needs through long-term engagement. As users pass through cycles of the hook model, they learn to meet their needs with the habit-forming product. Effective hooks transition users from relying on external triggers to cueing mental associations with internal triggers. Users move from states of low engagement to high engagement, from low preference to high preference. You are now equipped to use the hook model to ask yourself these five fundamental questions for building effective hooks. 1. What do users really want? What pain is your product relieving? Internal trigger. 2. What brings users to your service? External trigger. 3. What is the simplest action users take in anticipation of reward, and how can you simplify your product to make this action easier? Action. 4. Are users fulfilled by the reward yet left wanting more? Variable reward. 5. What bit of work do users invest in your product? Does it load the next trigger and store value to improve the product with use? Investment. The morality of manipulation. Now that you're aware of the pattern for building habit-forming technology, how will you use this knowledge? Perhaps while reading this book, you ask yourself if the hook model is a recipe for manipulation. Maybe you felt a bit unsettled reading what seemed like a cookbook for mind control. If so, that is a very good thing. The hook model is fundamentally about changing people's behaviors, but the power to build persuasive products should be used with caution. Creating habits can be a force for good, but it can also be used for nefarious purposes. What responsibility do product makers have when creating user habits? Let's admit it. We are all in the persuasion business. Innovators build products meant to persuade people to do what we want them to do. We call these people users, and even if we don't say it out loud, we secretly wish every one of them would become fiendishly hooked to whatever we're making. I'm guessing that it's likely why you started reading this book. Users take their technologies with them to bed. When they wake up, they check for notifications, tweets, and updates, sometimes even before saying good morning to their loved ones. Ian Bogost, the famed game creator and professor, calls the wave of habit-forming technologies the cigarette of this century and warns of their equally addictive and potentially destructive side effects. You may be asking, when is it wrong to manipulate users? Manipulation is an experience crafted to change behavior. We all know what it feels like. we're uncomfortable when we sense someone is trying to make us do something we wouldn't do otherwise, like when sitting through a car salesman's spiel or hearing a time-sharing presentation. Yet manipulation doesn't always have a negative connotation. If it did, how could we explain the numerous multi-billion dollar industries that rely heavily on users being willingly manipulated? If manipulation is an experience crafted to change behavior, then Weight Watchers, one of the most successful mass manipulation products in history, fits the definition. Weight Watchers customers' decisions are programmed by the designer of the system, yet few question the morality of the business. What, therefore, is the difference? Why is manipulating users through flashy advertising or addictive video games thought to be distasteful, while a strict system of food rationing is considered laudable? Although many people see Weight Watchers as an acceptable form of user manipulation, our moral compass has not caught up with what the latest technology now makes possible. Ubiquitous access to the web, transferring greater amounts of personal data at faster speeds than ever before, has created a more potentially addictive world. According to famed Silicon Valley investor Paul Graham, we haven't had time to develop societal antibodies to addictive new things. Graham places responsibility on the user. Unless we want to be canaries in the coal mine of each new addiction, the people whose sad example becomes a lesson to future generations, we'll have to figure out for ourselves what to avoid and how. What of the people, then, who make these manipulative experiences? After all, the corporations that unleash these habit-forming, at times downright addictive technologies, are made up of human beings with a moral sense of right and wrong. They, too, have families and kids who are susceptible to manipulation. What shared responsibilities do we so-called growth hackers and behavior designers have to our users, to future generations, and to ourselves? With the increasing pervasiveness and persuasiveness of personal technology, some industry insiders have proposed creating an ethical code of conduct. Others believe differently. Chris Nodder, author of the book Evil by Design, writes, "It's okay to deceive people if it's in their best interests, or if they've given implicit consent to be deceived as part of a persuasive strategy. I offer the Manipulation Matrix, a simple decision support tool entrepreneurs, employees, and investors can use long before product is shipped or code is written. The Manipulation Matrix does not try to answer which businesses are moral or which will succeed, nor does it describe what can and cannot become a habit-forming technology. The Matrix seeks to help you answer not, can I hook my users, but instead, should I attempt to? To use the Manipulation Matrix, the maker needs to ask two questions. First, would I use the product myself? And second, will the product help users materially improve their lives? Remember, this framework is for creating habit-forming products, not one-time use goods. Let's explore the types of creators who represent the four quadrants of the manipulation matrix. 1. The facilitator. When you create something that you would use that you believe makes the user's life better, you are facilitating a healthy habit. It is important to note that only you can decide if you would actually use the product or service and what materially improving the life of the user really means in light of what you are creating. If you find yourself squirming as you ask yourself these questions or needing to qualify or justify your answers, stop. You failed. You have to truly want to use the product and believe it materially benefits your life as well as the lives of your users. One exception is if you would have been a user in your younger years. For example, in the case of an education company, you may not need to use the service right now, but are certain you would have used it in your not-so-distant past. Note, however, that the further you are from your former self, the lower your odds of success. In building a habit for a user other than you, you cannot consider yourself a facilitator unless you have experienced the problem firsthand. Jack Harriman grew up on a small farm in West Virginia. After graduating from the United States Naval Academy, Harriman served as an infantry and special operations platoon commander in the Marine Corps. He was in Iraq during the 2003 invasion and led men into fierce gun battles with enemy combatants. He assisted with disaster relief in Indonesia and Sri Lanka after the 2004 Asian tsunami. Harriman maintains that his encounter with extreme poverty abroad changed his life. After 7.5 years of active duty, Harriman realized that guns alone could not stop terrorists intent on harming Americans. "Desperate people commit desperate acts," Harriman says. After his service, Harriman founded Nuru International, a social venture targeting extreme poverty by changing the habits of people living in rural areas. However, exactly how Harriman would change the lives of the poorest people in the world was not clear to him until he decided to live among them. In Kenya, he discovered that basic practices of modern agriculture, like proper seed spacing, were still not used. Yet Harriman knew that simply teaching farmers new behaviors would not be enough. Instead, by drawing upon his own rural upbringing and experience living with the farmers, Harriman uncovered the obstacles in their way. He soon learned that the lack of access to financing for high-quality seeds and fertilizer kept farmers from utilizing yield-boosting techniques. Nuru is currently equipping farmers in Kenya and Ethiopia, helping them rise out of grinding poverty. It was only by becoming one of his users that Harriman could design solutions to meet their needs. Although it is a long way from Africa to Silicon Valley, the well-documented stories of the founders of Facebook and Twitter reveal they would likely see themselves as making products in the facilitator quadrant. A new breed of companies is now creating products to improve lives by implementing healthy habits. Whether getting users to exercise more, creating a habit of journaling, or improving back posture, these companies are run by authentic entrepreneurs who desperately want their products to exist, products that stem from a desire to satisfy their own needs. However, what if the usage of a well-intended product becomes extreme, even harmful? What about the users who go beyond forming habits and become full-fledged addicts? First, it is important to recognize that the percentage of users who form a detrimental dependency is very small. Industry estimates for pathological users of even the most habit-forming technologies, such as slot machine gambling, are just 1%. Addiction tends to manifest in people with a particular psychological profile. However, simply brushing off the issue as too small to matter dismisses the very real problems caused by technology addiction. For the first time, though, companies have access to data that could be used to flag which users are using their products too much. Whether companies choose to act on that data in a way that aids their users is naturally a question of corporate responsibility. Companies building habit-forming technologies have a moral obligation and perhaps someday a legal mandate to inform and protect users who are forming unhealthy attachments to their products. It would behoove entrepreneurs building potentially addictive products to set guidelines for identifying and helping addicted users. Yet, for the overwhelming majority of users, addiction to a product will never be a problem. Even though the world is becoming a potentially more addictive place, most people have the ability to self-regulate their behaviors. The role of facilitator fulfills the moral obligation for entrepreneurs building a product they will themselves use and that they believe materially improves the lives of others. As long as they have procedures in place to assist those who form unhealthy addictions, the designer can act with a clean conscience. To take liberties with Mahatma Gandhi's famous quote, facilitators build the change they want to see in the world. 2. The peddler. Heady altruistic ambitions can at times outpace reality. Too often, designers of manipulative technology have a strong motivation to improve the lives of their users, but when pressed, they admit they would not actually use their own creations. Their holier-than-thou products often try to gamify some task no one really wants to do by inserting run-of-the-mill incentives, such as badges or points that don't actually hold value for their users. Fitness apps, charity websites, and products that claim to suddenly turn hard work into fun often fall into this quadrant. Possibly the most common example of peddlers, though, is in advertising. Countless companies convince themselves they're making ad campaigns users will love. They expect their videos to go viral and their branded apps to be used daily. Their so-called reality distortion fields keep them from asking the critical question, would I actually find this useful? The answer to this uncomfortable question is nearly always no, so they twist their thinking until they can imagine a user they believe might find the ad valuable. Materially improving users' lives is a tall order, and attempting to create a persuasive technology that you do not use yourself is incredibly difficult. This puts designers at a heavy disadvantage because of their disconnect with their products and users. There's nothing immoral about peddling. In fact, many companies working on solutions for others do so out of purely altruistic reasons. It's just that the odds of successfully designing products for a customer you don't know extremely well are depressingly low. Peddlers tend to lack the empathy and insights needed to create something users truly want. Often, the peddler's project results in a time-wasting failure because the designers did not fully understand their users. As a result, no one finds the product useful. 3. The entertainer. Sometimes makers of products just want to have fun. If creators of a potentially addictive technology make something that they use but can't in good conscience claim improves users' lives, they're making entertainment. Entertainment is art and is important for its own sake. Art provides joy, helps us see the world differently, and connects us with the human condition. These are all important and age-old pursuits. Entertainment, however, has particular attributes of which the entrepreneur, employee, and investor should be aware when using the manipulation matrix. Art is often fleeting. Products that form habits around entertainment tend to fade quickly from users' lives. A hit song, repeated over and over again in the mind, becomes nostalgia after it is replaced by the next chart topper. A book like this one is read and thought about for a while until the next interesting piece of brain candy comes along. As we learned in the chapter on variable rewards, games like Farmville and Angry Birds engross users, but are then relegated to the gaming dustbin, along with other hyper-addictive has-beens such as Pac-Man and Mario Brothers. Entertainment is a hits-driven business because the brain reacts to stimulus by wanting more and more of it, ever hungry for continuous novelty. Building an enterprise on ephemeral desires is akin to running on an incessantly rolling treadmill. You have to keep up with the constantly changing demands of your users. In this quadrant, the sustainable business is not purely the game, the song, or the book. Profit comes from an effective distribution system for getting those goods to market while they're still hot, and at the same time keeping the pipeline full of fresh releases to feed an eager audience. 4. The dealer. Creating a product that the designer does not believe improves users' lives and that he himself would not use is called exploitation. In the absence of these two criteria, presumably the only reason the designer is hooking users is to make a buck. Certainly, there is money to be made addicting users to behaviors that do little more than extract cash, and where there is cash, there will be someone willing to take it. The question is that someone you? Casinos and drug dealers offer users a good time, but when the addiction takes hold, the fun stops. In a satirical take on Zynga's Farmville franchise, Ian Bogost created Cow Clicker, a Facebook game in which users did nothing but incessantly click on virtual cows to hear a satisfying moo. Bogost intended to lampoon Farmville by blatantly implementing the same game mechanics and viral hacks he thought would be laughably obvious to users. But after the app's usage exploded and some people became frighteningly obsessed with the game, Bogost shut it down, bringing on what he called the cowpocalypse. Bogost rightfully compared addictive technology to cigarettes. Certainly, the incessant need for a smoke in what was once a majority of the adult U.S. population has been replaced by a nearly equal compulsion to constantly check our electronic devices. Yet, unlike the addiction to nicotine, new technologies offer an opportunity to dramatically improve users' lives. Like all technologies, recent advances in the habit-forming potential of digital innovation have both positive and negative effects. If the innovator has a clear conscience that the product materially improves people's lives, first among them, the designers, then the only path is to push forward. With the exception of the addicted 1%, users bear ultimate responsibility for their actions. However, as the march of technology makes the world a potentially more addictive place, innovators need to consider their role. It will be years, perhaps generations, before society develops the mental antibodies to control new habits. In the meantime, many of these behaviors may develop harmful side effects. For now, users must learn to assess these yet unknown consequences for themselves, while creators will have to live with the moral repercussions of how they spend their professional lives. My hope is that the manipulation matrix helps innovators consider the implications of the products they create. Perhaps after reading this book, you'll start a new business. Maybe you'll join an existing company with a mission to which you are committed. Possibly you will decide it is time to quit your job because you've come to realize it no longer points in the same direction as your moral compass. Remember and share. To help you, as a designer of habit-forming technology, assess the morality behind how you manipulate users, it is helpful to determine which of the four categories your work fits into. Are you a facilitator, peddler, entertainer, or dealer? Facilitators use their own product and believe it can materially improve people's lives. They have the highest chance of success because they most closely understand the needs of their users. Peddlers believe their product can materially improve people's lives, but do not use it themselves. They must be aware of the hubris and inauthenticity that comes from building solutions for people they do not understand firsthand. Entertainers use their product, but do not believe it can improve people's lives. They can be successful, but without making the lives of others better in some way, the entertainer's products often lack staying power. Dealers neither use the product nor believe it can improve people's lives. They have the lowest chance of finding long-term success and often find themselves in morally precarious positions. Do this now. Take a minute to consider where you fall on the manipulation matrix. Do you use your own product or service? Does it influence positive or negative behaviors? How does it make you feel? Ask yourself if you are proud of the way you are influencing the behavior of others. Chapter 7. Case Study: The Bible App. In the previous chapter, I urge you to be a facilitator and use the tools in this book to improve the lives of others. I encourage you to align your work with a purpose that provides you with meaning and helps cultivate meaning for others. This is not only a moral imperative, it's good business practice. The most highly regarded entrepreneurs are driven by meaning, a vision for greater good that drives them forward. Startups are grueling, and only the most fortunate persevere before finding success. If you only build for fame or fortune, you will likely find neither. Build for meaning, though, and you can't go wrong. The Hook Model is a framework based on human psychology and a close examination of today's most successful habit-forming products. Now that you have an understanding of the model and the psychology behind why we do the things we do, let's study how it all comes together in one of the world's most popular apps. Whether or not you agree with the mission of the app described below is unimportant. The lesson here is how a technology company created a user habit while staying true to the